Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. This week, a new book called Lastingness explores the work of creative artists who worked into their 70s or even later. The Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles lets you literally dive into the art. Museumgoers are able to swim in a pool with art projected on both sides. And a new album features a mezzo-soprano who plays both men and women. But first,
most great piano music comes straight from the middle of the keyboard. If you were the one sitting at the piano playing a piece like this, your fingers would mostly stay right in front of you. You'd rarely go to the tinkly high notes off to your right or the booming bass notes off to your left. Yet a craftsman in Australia thinks the instrument has room to grow. He's added more keys at each end. Neva Grant reports on a really grand piano.
It weighs 1,400 pounds, but can sound as fragile as spun glass or as tough as a foghorn. The Stewart & Sons grand piano has 14 more keys than most, which means the lowest and highest notes live very much on the edge. To show you, let's first sit down at the Yamaha Grand at NPR with the typical 88 keys. On the left-hand side of the piano, you can go down this low. On the Stewart piano, you can go 9 notes lower. Now the high notes, first on the Yamaha Grand. We can go up to here. And on the Stewart, 5 extra notes up.
I would hate to go back to playing an 88-note piano. Can't stand it. Too limited.
Piano designer Wayne Stewart says a few other grands can play as low as his 102-key model, but none can play as high. It's a great feat of acrobatics, you might say, but those extra notes really aren't that musical. So why have them? For color, says Stewart, and resonance.
There's a tremendous amount of energy there in the low octave notes. You can hear the power.
Actually, you can sense the power, even in pieces where the lowest notes aren't played.
Beethoven might have actually loved the sound of the Stewart piano.
Concert pianist Gerard Willems has recorded most of Beethoven's works on a Stewart Grand. Willems says Beethoven only had about 70 keys on his piano, and he would have used more notes if he'd had them. But don't focus too much on the keys, he says. The Stewart piano has other innovations. Its strings vibrate differently from other pianos. So even when you play many notes at once, says Willems, each sound rings out clear and separate.
It's almost like sort of taking wool, and you pull the wool apart, and you can feel and you can sense and smell each different layer of the sound.
But if the Stewart piano is going to attract more attention, it has to attract living composers to write for it. And that's starting to happen.
It's probably the best piano I've ever played on.
New Age jazz musician Fiona Joy Hawkins has composed pieces for the Stewart piano. Listen for those whispery high notes.
What it lends itself to is the ability to get a lot more from a single note. It just doesn't have any bend in the decay. It just goes straight. It goes forever. So you get these incredible harmonics that last.
Some people say the Stewart has a distinctly Australian sound, as clear and bright as sun on the beach. But even here in Australia, the instrument has its critics. Pianist and music professor Jeffrey Lancaster would not say this piano is sunny.
I find the sounds very cold. They don't have that dimension of warmth that, say, a great Steinway does. It's this clarity, this so-called clarity, this crystalline quality. It's really quite icy.
The Stuart Grand can't expect to compete with a giant like Steinway. Only about 40 of the pianos have been sold worldwide. But Jeffrey Lancaster says the Stuart raises an important question. When do we stop innovating?
The idea back even 150 years ago was that each piano should be a masterpiece in its own right and should not necessarily resemble the piano that was made before it. That's changed, of course. We now have pianos from many fine makers around the world, which are all fundamentally the same. So I'm all for innovation in the modern piano.
And how you innovate, he says, depends, as always, on personal taste. And if you want a Stuart, you'll need personal finances, too. The top model costs $300,000 delivered. For NPR News, I'm Neva Grant in Sydney.
There's a lot of talk these days about things being immersive, as in immersive video games, immersive 3D movies, immersive education programs. Well, now at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, there's an immersive exhibit, as in you can actually swim in it. Reporter Alex Schmidt took the plunge.
The pool is tucked into a dark back corner of the museum. It's the size of a mini lap pool and 3 feet deep, and it's ringed with small blue lights. There's a creepy soundtrack playing, and cameras project big images on either side of the pool, featuring lines of cocaine. The piece is called CC4 Notations. It was conceived in 1973 by Brazilian artists Elio Oiticica and Neville de Almeida. MoCA curator Alma Ruiz says the piece was about freedom during an oppressive Brazilian regime, freedom to experience art differently, even to do drugs. Today, though, she says it has another meaning.
We sometimes get so removed by living virtual lives, and I think it is more relevant today to think about the physicality of the exhibition, the fact that you have to experience the work not just with the eyes, but with your ears, with your body, with your skin.
Yes, visitors are invited to swim in the pool. The museum even sells $16 disposable bathing suits in case you've come unprepared. Keenan Blau had brought his own. He was just getting out of the pool when I arrived.
The colors like reflect interesting images onto like the surface, so it really like intensifies like the pool. It's pretty refreshing. I like it.
No more putting it off. It was my turn to get in.
Freezing. Oh my God, it's freezing.
I wonder whether the janitor mopping is part of the art piece, but I don't think he is.
Neither is the lifeguard, but according to California law, the museum needs to have one. The blue lights played nicely on the surface of the water, and I could have lost myself in colorful, trippy visuals. But the cold was a pretty big distraction, and so were all the people around the pool.
It makes you feel a little bit weird and embarrassed to be in front of museum goers, and you're in a bathing suit in a pool.
Jonathan Lewis got in soon after me. He thought the awkwardness was the point.
It's weird. The moment you realize you're part of the exhibit, because I was swimming probably for about 5 minutes, and then suddenly I realized that all these people are just standing around staring at me in the exhibit. So that's what makes it so incredibly immersive, to actually participate in this exhibit. It's awesome.
True. I suppose being made to feel uncomfortable is sometimes the whole point of art. But the cold, I could have done without. For NPR News, I'm Alex Schmidt.
In 1928, when the poet William Butler Yeats had entered his 60s, he wrote Sailing to Byzantium, which begins, "That is no country for old men." And the second stanza starts, "An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick." Yeats is one of the artists Nicholas Del Banco writes about in his new book, Lastingness. It is Del Banco's rumination on the art of old age. It's about what artists of all media do in their later years. And while Nicholas Del Banco arrives at no simple, sweeping judgment, he reminds us of how many creative artists defy the limitations of old age and sometimes transcend them to achieve new levels of creativity. Mr. Del Banco himself has been teaching and writing for over 40 years, and he joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You write near the beginning of Lastingness about your own writing, "I can remember when each morning seemed a burnished, shining thing, when every afternoon and night brought with it the possibility of something or someone not known before. Today there's very little new beneath the fictive sun." So This is an inquiry that begins really with your own experience of writing and reaching the ripe old age of 68.
Yes, I think that's true. It's not the sort of book I would have been interested in writing, much less reading, 30 or 40 years ago. But for obvious reasons, since you've named my present age, the business of old age is of incremental interest to me. And though I used as a kind of cutoff point the age of 70 and wrote about artists who at least maintained, and in some cases, as with Yeats, advanced their art past the age of 70, that's no longer such a distant prospect, and I found myself staring at it.
I think one of the most wonderful stories you relate here about an artist in old age is the story of the painter Claude Monet. I want you to tell us the story of Monet and the water lilies.
Well, he became fixated on, compelled by the gardens of a house that he bought about 20 miles outside of Paris called Giverny. And over the last 20-plus years of his life, he painted almost exclusively the natural world. In fact, he painted almost obsessively up until he died at 86. And this habit of inward-focused concentration is almost characteristic of the artist in old age.
One thing about old age in the story of Monet is that in his 80s he wasn't as mobile as he was when he was a younger man. He was sedentary because he was an old man in part, and therefore his universe had shrunk physically, no?
Very definitely. I mean, the notion of those impressionists in winter, if you will, the ones who went out and stood in the snow and the ice with a little charcoal brazier to keep them warm and stayed there for hours, that's not something that an octogenarian would do.
That's a young man's
words. Exactly. In Monet's case, I think more importantly even than his physical agility was the threat to, and in the end, the wreckage of his eyesight. So Monet focused on the visible world in very different ways in his older age, yes.
And the works of his old age today are regarded as
as the masterpieces.
The masterpieces.
Right.
Lastingness, your book, is this is not a journalistic or an analytic effort. And you write that a big part of your very limited investigation was sending the late John Updike a set of questions, written questions that he answered. And I especially liked his answer to your question, how have your aspirations changed?
Oh, he was marvelous. I must say, Robert, that John's letter was an exception that proved the rule. He was so eloquent.
Yes, he said, the aspirations have not been dulled. But after years in the mines, I am aware that my major veins have probably been dug out, and the urgency of my youthful, quote, news presses less groaningly. And he goes on from there.
That's true, but it's also fair to say that he was always disparaging his own energy, his own enthusiasm, his own ability. I never frankly knew how far his tongue was in his cheek, but he was declaring himself finished in his late 20s, which is when I first met him.
There's a natural tension here when we address the subject of artists being old. On the one hand, we associate old age with wisdom and experience and some knowledge about the world. On the other hand, it's the young artist who's seeing it all for the first time, who's capable of the truly novel first impression. And in a way, it's a lot less surprising to think that young people produce brilliant pieces of art.
Well, I think that's true. And indeed, if one could do such a statistical analysis, it's probably the case that most of what we construe to be masterworks of our culture have been produced by people under the age of 40, if only because very few people live past that up until relatively recently. But on the face of it, it remains a puzzling question. I mean, if you're a baseball player or a ballerina, you kind of know that your career is over by the age of 40, and you certainly wouldn't begin it at that point. But in terms of the subject matter and on the face of it, there's no intrinsic reason why an artist couldn't grow with age. But it happens so relatively rarely that I thought I would puzzle it out in this book.
Nicholas Del Banco, thank you very much. for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a great pleasure.
Nicolas Del Banco's new book is called Lastingness, The Art of Old Age.
And now, the latest installment of our feature, In Your Ear. Joey Omicile is a Haitian-born musician whose craft often defies categorization. We spoke with him last year, months after the devastating earthquake in Haiti, and he shared his thoughts on Haiti's future and the refuge he finds in his music. And now he shares some of his favorite tunes.
My name is Joey Omicile. I'm a saxophonist, a multi-instrumentalist, basically educator, producer. And I love music. And one of my favorite songs, actually, is one of them, is Ornette Coleman, Peace. What I like about that song is the freedom in it and the melodic statement that Ornette Coleman is playing at this time, you know, with Charlie Hayden, and he was messing with Billy Higgins. I really love that song. It's a trio song, and it's naked, and I love peace because I love peace in my regular life, too. And then another one of my favorite song is Cubaciando. Cubaciando is composed by myself and Francisco Mela. And it's the wedding, basically, of Cuba and Haiti in terms of melodic statement and in terms of rhythmical vibes. So I really like to perform that song, and I like it. It's one of my favorite of all time for now. And then the last one, but not least, is a Charlie Parker song that I really, really, really like. I never recorded it, but I love it. It's Confirmation. In Confirmation, Bird is doing an étalage of bebop. Language, and also on different recording, I'm talking about the one at Carnegie Hall where he's playing with Dizzy Gillespie. Those two fellas, Dizzy and Bird, are really putting the bebop language in the 50s at that time out there in emphasis.
Voice of American opera superstar Joyce DiDonato. She's singing the role of the teenaged composer in Richard Strauss's opera Ariadna auf Naxos. The character here is a boy, and it's one of the recordings from her new album. It's called Diva Devo, and on it, Joyce DiDonato performs 16 male and female roles from some of the most famous operas ever written, including this role, the composer, from Ariadna auf Naxos.
He's about 17 or 18 years old, a very young composer who has just had the world opened up in front of him because he's actually discovered a type of love for the first time. He's one of these sort of geeks that spent his whole life composing, and everything was about music, and all of a sudden this... And he's writing about love all the time. And then this young, very flirtatious girl appears in front of him, and they have this wonderful duet and wonderful discussion. And for the first time, he sees in flesh and blood, in living color, all these things that he's been writing about. What I love about this is you hear the enthusiasm in him, and you hear these sort of wild leaps, which is very masculine. And so for me, getting into the mindset of that, it's all in the music Richard Strauss has given us.
Joyce, I want to ask you for a moment about you. In the liner notes on this recording, you write that you didn't actually fall in love with opera at first hearing, that it actually took you a long time, and I was surprised to read that.
You know, opera is such a personal thing. I think some people come for the first time and they're moved to tears and their life is changed immediately. Other people, it's more like sort of wine. You sort of develop an appreciation for it as you learn about it more. My passion was ignited when I stepped on the stage and I actually entered into the world of opera from the inside.
And of course, you studied opera. You studied it. You are from Kansas City and you studied at Wichita State University. Were you kind of an oddball growing up?
Well, you know, I was a theater kid and I was the choir geek. And so I entered university to be a music teacher and I got sidetracked pretty violently.
Significantly, yeah. I mean, because you never intended to be an opera singer?
I didn't know. I mean, I loved the stage. When I was little, I dreamed of being on the stage, but I think I was modest enough to say, you know, maybe I could be a backup singer for Billy Joel. That would be really cool.
Maybe you still can be.
Does anybody have his number? No. I mean, I loved that idea, but I think coming from a very sort of modest background, I don't know that I allowed myself to dream that big.
You're hearing the voice of the opera singer Joyce DiDonato. Her new record is called Diva Devo. Obviously, this record, there's a lot of gender bending. But then there's this other layer here, which is you have two takes on every story. So the same operatic story told by two different composers. You've got two different versions of Faust, for example, two different versions of Cinderella. Why did you do that?
Well, it was a way to try and tell stories. You know, one of my favorite elements of the opera world is that it's theater. And I liked this idea of exploring the same story and learning from two different composers what the musical language that they used to create this. For example, there's a Clemenza di Tito, the Clemency of Titus story. And in one I sing the young adolescent boy who's in love with the older manipulative woman. And she has asked him to kill the emperor to prove his love for her. And he's very conflicted, obviously, but he agrees to do it because he loves her so much. And his piece by Gluck is very plangent and has this astonishing oboe solo going over it. And it's poetic and wonderful. And it's very feminine in a way. Then you have the woman, and she's manipulative, and she's full of vengeance, and she's fabulous. And this is Mozart's world, and he gives her this cutting, angular, almost harsh sort of opening to the piece. And it's actually quite aggressive in what you would think of as masculine. So I found it fascinating to see how the composers viewed these different stories and the different genders and the theater of it.
Joyce DiDonato, there's a story about you that just seems unbelievable to me, but perhaps I'll let you tell it. And this is how you once sang an opera with a broken leg.
Oh, You know, I've actually gone back and for a while I put a moratorium on people telling me to break a leg because it did actually happen on stage. But now I'm laughing in the face of fate. It was opening night of The Barber of Seville at Covent Garden, and it was a pretty star-studded cast, and there was a lot of buzz around it. And as Rosina, I have the opening aria of Una Voce Poco Fa, which I've sung, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And I thought, okay, this went pretty well. I'm feeling pretty good about this. And I took a little jog across the stage in conversation with the Figaro, and I fell. I ended up getting into a cast and finishing the run of the show in a bright neon pink cast that matched my costume perfectly. And I wheeled myself around the stage. It was pretty incredible.
Amazing story. I know you're performing in Dead Man Walking at the Houston Grand Opera right now, and then you've got this very busy schedule of international performances for the rest of the year. So I will not say what people shouldn't say to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
And Joyce, that role that you performed with your broken leg, Rosina, you also sing it on this album.
Yes, I do.
Joyce DiDonato's new recording is called Diva Devo. It comes out next Tuesday, but you can hear the entire album at our website, nprmusic.org. And if you're in Houston or in the Houston area, you have until February 6th to see Joyce in the opera Dead Man Walking at the Houston Grand Opera. Joyce DiDonato, thank you so much.
Thanks. It was a real pleasure.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.